It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The 2026 Winter Olympics wrapped up Sunday, and Wisconsin athletes are making headlines around the world.
That's the sound from Milwaukee Sunday morning as the men's U.S. hockey team competed for gold. Both U.S. men's and women's ice hockey teams ultimately won gold this year, with more than a quarter of the women's team having played for the UW Badgers hockey team.
Speed skater and Kewaskum native Jordan Stolz took home three Olympic medals in Italy, losing his chance for a fourth medal Saturday by 0.09 of a second.
Jenny Peek is an editor at Wisconsin Public Radio and writes the Wisconsin Today newsletter. She's been closely following the U.S. women's hockey team and attended a watch party in Madison. Jenny, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Evan Casey is with us, WPR reporter covering the greater Milwaukee area and southeast Wisconsin. He was at a watch party for speed skater Jordan Stolz. Evan, welcome back.
Yeah, good to be here. Thanks.
Jenny, let's start with the women's hockey team. You were at a watch party. What was the atmosphere like?
Yeah, so I was in Madison at the Student Union, and the atmosphere was amazing. People of all ages there, your standard USA chants, and the most massive cheers anytime one of these UW Badger women were on screen. I talked to a 9-year-old named Nora who skipped school to watch the game with her mom and her older brother, and she just started playing hockey, and she said she was dreaming of being like the women she was watching, and it was really this cute moment.
And Evan, you were at a watch party for the men's team Sunday. Set the scene for us.
Yeah, it was great. That game started at 7 a.m. on a Sunday. So there wasn't, you know, hundreds of people at the bar I went to, but there's, you know, about 30, 40 people gathered there to watch the game. They were handing out coffee and I had some Kringle as well. So it was great. I mean, when we won in overtime, the place erupted with cheer. It was really fun. It was a lot of fun watching that with people.
And Jenny, speaking of overtime, the women's game. I don't know. It was a tense time, I imagine. Were there a lot of gasps of dismay at pivotal moments?
Yeah, I mean, the room was tense. People were gasping and awing and then cheering. And there was a lot of up and down momentum there.
Let's dig into some of the team now, Jenny. You've been following the women's team since before the Olympics. What moment stuck out to you the most based on that experience as you're watching the hockey team win gold?
So that game was a considerably more rocky start in comparison to their other games. They were just dominant throughout the series, almost shutting out every single team that they played, scoring at least 5 goals in every game. And so to see that slow start, I think people were a little bit apprehensive. Canada really upped its game and seemed like they were out for revenge. But much like a lot of the series, these Badger athletes really stood out. Notably, the shot on gold from current Badger Layla Edwards late in the third period. Captain Hillary Knight deflected that into the goal to tie it 1-1. And, you know, that really turned the tide for Team USA. And without that Badger connection, I don't think we would have seen overtime.
Right, Jenny, we're talking about the women's hockey team in particular in Wisconsin because there's such a huge Wisconsin connection. You just spelled out some of the key players there. Tell us a little more.
Yeah, so there were six UW Badger athletes playing on Team USA, 4 current UW Badgers and 2 former. So I mentioned Layla Edwards, who plays for the Badgers now, and Captain Hillary Knight, who played from 2007 to 2012. There's also Caroline KK Harvey, Kirsten Sims, and Ava McNaughton, and Britta Curl Salem. And Carolyn was also kind of a standout player throughout the series. And it's kind of amazing just to see this representation of UW-Madison Badgers on the ice in Canada. Like you mentioned, a quarter of the team were Badgers, and it was the most from any other team.
We are talking about Wisconsin athletes making history at the Winter Olympics in Italy with WPR reporters Jenny Peek and Evan Casey. Evan, let's take off our hockey skates and lace on our speed skates. I assume they're different. 21-year-old speed skater Jordan Stolz ultimately won 3 Olympic medals this year. You also ran a watch party for him at Stolz's elementary school in Hartford late last week. What was that hometown crowd like?
It was awesome. It was great. I mean, there had to be hundreds of students from that school all packed into the same gym that he actually grew up in, running around in himself. They watched the broadcast on this little projector that was at the end of the gym. I mean, I couldn't hear myself think for like maybe the half an hour that they were in there. He was actually the last set of the day. So students got in there a little bit early, watched some of the other races. And anytime that Jordan was on the screen, they just went like nuts. It was crazy. They were obviously chanting his name. A lot of them had American flags that they were waving. And then when he started the race, I mean, it was just nonstop screaming basically in the gym. I looked over and I saw some of his former teachers as well were just right across from me, and a few of them were tearing up and crying, and it was very emotional for them, obviously. Jordan didn't even get gold that race, but I don't think it mattered to any of them who were in that gym.
And Jordan, when you found Evan, when you found quiet enough moments, you talked to some teachers and students there at the elementary school in Hartford. What kind of things did they have to say?
Yeah, it was cool. I actually walked into the gym and his old PE teacher was standing there and told us to look up, and Jordan's name was actually on the board right there. He actually won a record or got a record for the school's, I think it's like most push-ups in a minute, and his name was still up there, so she was really proud of that. A few other of his teachers, like his third grade teacher, said that he was just a really quiet kid, very humble. But she said that, you know, when he smiled, he pretty much lit up the whole room. Another teacher I spoke to said that, you know, he was just thankful for Jordan giving him the opportunity to say that he was able to teach an Olympic gold medal athlete. So it was really fun for him as well. So all of them spoke very highly of him. He actually went to the school about 3 years ago after the 2022 Olympics. He visited the school again. So the principal is hoping that he comes back sometime soon to kind of share with all the students again this victory as well.
Well, Jenny, Evan took us behind the scenes there. You also had a behind the scenes moment. You got to see three of the players on the U.S. women's hockey team practicing in Madison just a few weeks back. What sticks out to you when you see them performing in practice, not on that big Olympic stage?
Yeah, it was pretty fun. I was at the Laban Arena on the UW-Madison campus, and some of these names will sound familiar. I mentioned them a bit ago. I was watching Caroline Harvey, Kirsten Sims, and Ava McNaughton practice, and they just had such a bond. You know, like they're fierce on the ice no matter where they are, and they were really focused, taking things really seriously. But I talked to them after their practice, and Kirsten Sims was saying how nice it was to be able to go over to Milan with these teammates. It was like taking a little bit of home with them. And Harvey is just a truly insane athlete. You know, throughout the Olympic series, she tied for the most points scored throughout the series. She was named MVP, best defender, made the media all-star team. It's her second Olympic showing. And she was just so humble and really pointed to her teammates as the reason why they had any chance of getting gold. And then Ava McNaughton is a goaltender, and she was the second youngest player on the team. She was so excited to be there. She wasn't expecting to see any playing time, but she got to take to the ice and made a save against Switzerland, which was really special to see. And, you know, they were just really excited to be there. You know, there didn't they were just really like amping each other up the whole time in practice, while in Milan, while talking to me.
Evan, you talked to ski jumper Ben Loomis yesterday. He's from Eau Claire and competed in the Nordic combined event in Italy. He made headlines for an odd wrinkle of the final jump in his Olympic career. Here's what he told you about it.
One of the leaf blowers, I guess, wasn't quite paying attention and unfortunately didn't move his in time. So kind of clipped me on the shoulder as I was going down the in run. Fortunately, it's totally fine. Didn't get hurt. Still had a pretty good jump after that, but it was just kind of funny that was my last Olympic competition jump. Something like that happened. So definitely will remember that for a while or forever.
Evan, how did Ben ultimately place?
Yeah, he got 17th and then 27th in his individual competitions. And that's for the normal hill and then the large hill individual competition. I didn't know a lot about the sport until yesterday. Apparently, it combines, you know, ski jumping and cross-country skiing, but that was actually his last Olympic competition. He doesn't plan to compete in 2030. So, kind of a bittersweet for him, year for him, but he said that 17th was great for him. He was really happy with what he did.
And briefly, Jenny, speaking of last competitions, Hillary Knight, Badger, five-time Olympian, captain of Team USA, said, hey, this is her last Olympic game. Briefly, her influence, this Badger's influence on ice hockey.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, Hillary Knight is essentially the face of women's hockey. She's 36 years old. She was the captain of Team USA. She's captain of the Seattle Torrent of the Professional Women's Hockey League. And that league didn't exist until 2023. And I think that that's like such an important point. The Professional Women's Hockey League is so, so new, and she played a really key role in creating it. She fought for it. And without her, there wouldn't be this opportunity for these women post-college, post-Olympics. And while she was in Milan for her fifth time, she set the record for most Olympic goals ever scored for Team USA Women's Hockey. And so she's just really stamping her legacy in there and will continue to be a huge name in women's hockey, at least on the professional circuit.
And Evan, can you round up how some of the other Wisconsin Olympians fared in Italy?
Yeah, there's a Pewaukee native, Jaden O'Brien. I don't know if you heard about her. She actually picked up or touched a bobsled, I should say, for the first time in October. And she competed in the two women bobsled. She finished seventh in her Olympic debut. Marcus Mueller, he's a Brookfield kid. He took sixth place in the men's double luge and then fifth in the luge mixed events. That were kind of some of the big other names. There was also some biathletes as well who competed from Wisconsin, as well as a student who went to Marquette University. But Jenny and I looked yesterday. There's about 13, we think, people from Wisconsin who either were born there or who have ties to the state who competed in the Olympics.
And Jenny, very briefly, a bunch of Wisconsinites, Badgers actually on Team Canada.
Yeah, definitely. So there were five former Badgers, so they're not current Badger players, but five of them playing for Team Canada. And so there's just the UW-Madison hockey program really churns out Olympic athletes. Their coach, Mark Johnson, was pivotal in the 1980 Miracle on Ice men's game. And so he knows how to train Olympic athletes, and young women seek out the university to get that training, to work under someone that knows what it takes, the focus, the importance of just staying with your head in the game.
Then we'll leave it there. Thanks to Jenny and Evan, Jenny Peek and Evan Casey, both of WPR, bringing us up to date on Wisconsinites and Badgers in the Winter Olympics.
Coming up, FEMA rejects a state appeal to pay for millions of dollars in public infrastructure repairs related to the severe floods in August. Emergency management officials from Milwaukee and Door County have reaction.
This caliber of event doesn't happen all the time, but when it does, we have to have a better line of sight on how we can, you know, take care of people and the infrastructure that is affected.
That's ahead on WPR News.
Earlier this month, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, announced it had rejected Governor Evers' appeal for more than $26 million in aid for public infrastructure damage in six counties.
That's after severe storms and flooding swept through last August. It leaves questions as to how these counties will come up with the millions of dollars to cover the repair costs.
FEMA wrote in a letter to the governor stating that this funding was, quote, not warranted. The federal agency did grant a separate request for nearly $30 million in funding to homeowners and businesses.
The Trump administration said after its decision that states are obligated to recover from disasters and federal funds are meant as a supplement.
In Wisconsin, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said emergency aid is a federal responsibility while noting he'd be open to providing more money from the state.
To learn more about what's next for these communities, we're joined by Chris McGowan, Deputy Director of the Milwaukee County Office of Emergency Management. And Jeb Salins is here, Director of Door County Emergency Management. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for inviting us.
Chris, starting with you, Milwaukee County's executive said last fall that the county can afford to put county funds toward repairing public infrastructure that was damaged in the severe floods in August. In Milwaukee County, what repairs are still needed over 6 months later?
So within our municipalities, a lot of our municipalities were holding back, waiting to see what the final determination was going to be for the public assistance side of the FEMA funding. So we have not gotten any reports on any progress that they've had in the local jurisdictions on what repairs they've made there. Here as a county agency, we were affected by the floods, and several of the projects have moved forward. Several of the projects have not moved forward. So our agency, in one of our other disciplines, we took a significant amount of damage to one of our radio infrastructure units, and we were forced to make repairs to those out of our operating funds in order to get that back online to 100% capacity.
And so the several projects that haven't been started yet, what are the dollar figures on them, and what is not underway?
So that I don't have an accurate report on. So I know that as a county, the public assistance request that we put forward to go in with the state was at or near $20 million worth of public infrastructure. Hmm. And so to what extent some of those projects have moved forward, I'm not sure. I know that our Metro Milwaukee Sewer District is moving forward on some of their projects. I just don't know to what extent or what dollar amount they're moving forward with.
Jeb, turning to you, can you give us a bit of a rundown for Door County? What type of damage hasn't been repaired yet, and what were you seeking federal funding for to cover those costs?
So our damages were a little bit different from Milwaukee's. Milwaukee had a lot of flooding, where our damage was more around debris removal. Mm. So we had one tornado touchdown in Peninsula State Park, and then a couple water spouts out in the bay. Some straight line winds also affected the northern half of our county. So most of our damage was debris removal. So most of that was cleaned up in the weeks following the event. Newport State Park was our one exception. They had massive area of down trees. So they were able to clean those up this winter. They had a crew come in and remove those. Yeah.
Jeb, some people might be thinking, you know, debris removal can't be that costly for a community like Door County. Has debris removal been a challenge?
Well, it definitely has. Door County is a rural community. You know, a lot of these towns and villages that were affected are small villages, you know, 1,500 or less people. When you have incurred costs in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, that's a lot for a small municipality.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Chris, FEMA did offer nearly $30 million in federal aid to households and to businesses for flooding recovery. And this recently denied funding was for assistance with public infrastructure, as you're well aware. Do you have any clarity as to why this request for funding was denied?
No, unfortunately, we don't have any answers to why this was denied. That's something that we've been having discussions with Wisconsin Emergency Management and trying to reach out to federal partners to try and get some line of sight on why the public assistance portion of this was denied. But even though we put in for and were granted $30 million as a state for individual assistance, Milwaukee County actually saw over $152 million that was allocated to our citizens. So we started at $30 million allocation, and we ended with our community being supported with $150 million.
We are talking about next steps for communities around Wisconsin after FEMA denied more than $26 million in disaster relief funds following severe flooding and storms last August. Chris McGowan is here, Deputy Director of the Milwaukee County Office of Emergency Management, and we're also checking in with Jeb Salins, Door County Emergency Management Director. Jeb, what other ways can counties or municipalities get assistance for these infrastructure repair costs, especially when a community, you know, is small, as you mentioned, and you know, where do they turn to?
Yeah, so since our application for our federal funding was denied, we are now working with Wisconsin Emergency Management. So the state does have a Wisconsin Disaster Fund, which mimics the federal program. It's a little bit different, but mimics it. So we're working with them to reach out to our municipalities and develop applications so that they can get reimbursed for some of their funding as well.
How does the Wisconsin Disaster Fund work?
It's based on the municipality's population, and then if they reach a threshold of cost, then they're able to apply for reimbursement.
You know, Chris, the West Allis mayor had told a TV station that the state's disaster relief fund isn't as robust as FEMA's program. What does that mean for communities that would, you know, seek to dip into the disaster fund for Wisconsin?
So the benefit of the Wisconsin Disaster Fund is that now that we've gotten the PA denial from the federal government, the state has a funding source to be able to help out as much as possible the municipalities that took damage during this event. The mayor in West Allis is correct that it's not as robust as the federal government's funding source, and the reimbursement rate is much less, but it is still something. So short of the disaster relief fund from Wisconsin, municipalities and taxpayers will have to shoulder the burden of this damage, or priorities will have to be set to be able to decide what projects move forward and what projects don't, and on what timeline.
Could you speak more to that? I mean, could local residents who are hearing this end up footing the bill on some of these infrastructure repair projects?
Well, it will be dependent on each individual municipality to decide how and what projects they move forward with. Mm-hmm. So it, based on what their projections are and what their budgetary allocations are in the years to come, which of these projects can move forward, which ones do they have funding for, which ones can they alter other projects in order to fund some of these infrastructure projects, they have to make more local decisions on what projects move forward and when and on what timeline.
Jeb, what comes up for you as you think about the local input of community members and what moves forward and who pays for it?
I know for us, one of the biggest things that weren't really covered with this process was actually the mitigation part of it. So we were denied federal funding for public assistance, but we were also denied mitigation dollars as well. And for communities that are rural and facing increased disasters, as we have been in the last few years, those were funds that we were really looking towards to help our community and prepare our community for the next time. That's one area that we were disappointed in. And unfortunately, not all of our communities will be able to apply for Wisconsin Disaster Fund because some of them just didn't make the threshold individually. So they will unfortunately have to foot the bill themselves.
Can you give an example of what mitigation funds might be used for to prepare for the next disaster?
Yeah, so Peninsula State Park is one of the biggest state parks in the state. It's probably our fifth largest municipality in the county on any given Saturday during the summer. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful place. I love going there, but it has no cell phone reception, which, you know, is kind of the nice part about camping out in the wilderness. But makes it very difficult to receive emergency alerts for tornadoes severe weather. So that was one project we were really hoping to fund with mitigation dollars to protect people that go up to Peninsula State Park.
So the White House said after rejecting this appeal that disaster recovery is a state's obligation. And leaders here like Governor Evers and Assembly Speaker Robin Voss disagree, saying it is a federal responsibility to help these communities out. You're on the ground dealing with these things as they happen. Chris, as you see this back and forth, is there a message that you want to send lawmakers, you know, and what they should hear?
During the event, when the event was happening, there were several of the lawmakers, federal lawmakers, their staff sat down with us and were asking about updates of how things were going on the ground. And the discussion that we had then was that unlike other disasters that we deal with, generally disasters are considered a community occurrence. Flooding specifically is more of an individual-based occurrence. And so when it comes to reimbursement, disaster funds, things like that, the perspective on how that gets judged is slightly different. And so this is the flooding event that we saw here tends to be thought of more as a individual taxpayer, individual community's problem, and not a community as a whole, like a tornado or a hurricane would be. And so my message would be to look at how flooding is looked at and evaluate how better or how best we can support the municipalities and the community and individual taxpayers moving forward for flooding events.
Jeb, as we close, your message to politicians about disasters?
Yeah, in this time that we're facing more and more disasters, it's a time where we need our federal government partners to do something big and bold and not just retreat from their responsibilities. We're all in this together. So, you know, we really need new ideas and also to fund local emergency management departments so we can get those boots on the ground and mitigation projects going, because that's how we're going to save money. You know, I understand that the federal government wants to cut money, but funding mitigation, for every dollar you spend on that, you get $6 back in response cost.
Wow.
That to me is a great way to help out local communities and also lessen the tax burden on individuals.
Well, Jeb and Chris, thank you so much for joining us and for this check-in.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
That is Chris McGowan, Deputy Director of the Milwaukee County Office of Emergency Management, and Jeb Salins, the Door County Emergency Management Director. We spoke about FEMA's denial of assistance for millions of dollars in public infrastructure repairs after severe storms and flooding swept through six counties last August.
Coming up, the Our Lady of Guadalupe statue visits Milwaukee with other stops coming in Wisconsin. The vicar for Hispanic ministry in the Archdiocese of Milwaukee tells us why the statue is so uplifting to Catholics.
I think it's a beautiful boost, if you will, of hope and joy to the faithful here in the Archdiocese of Milwaukee.
That's next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In preparation for the 500th anniversary of the apparition of Our Lady of Guadalupe, a life-sized holy statue of the patron saint of Mexico is making its way around the globe, and there are stops in Wisconsin.
The first Mass in the state was held at the Basilica of St. Josephat on Milwaukee's south side in a predominantly Latino neighborhood. Here are some voices out of the hundreds of people who turned out for the service.
The meaning for us of her being here, It's big. It's humongous.
She did really important stuff, and it was really beautiful to see.
Unirnos en la fe.
She showed up for kids.
The statue will journey through six other Wisconsin cities until April as part of its international spiritual tour.
To hear more about the importance of the icon to Catholics and Latinos, we have Father Juan Camacho, Vicar for Hispanic Ministry in the Archdiocese of Milwaukee and the pastor to eight parishes in Racine. He attended the first service of the statue unveiling last week. Father Juan, welcome.
I'm happy to be here today with you.
You saw this statue for the first time last week when it arrived in Milwaukee. Take us to that moment. What was the feeling like to see it in person and up close?
It was a very impressive moment because one of the things that this statue has is that the eyes of the Blessed Mother, the eyes of the statue, they seem to be very real, and they seem to be glassy, like if she was about to cry of seeing you. And that was very moving for me at that moment. And so, of course, by the people that were at the Basilica, it was a full Basilica that we have with people for the opening Mass and for visiting the Blessed Mother there.
People might pray to Our Lady of Guadalupe for healing or for protection or for peace. For you personally, would you share what did you pray for to Our Lady of Guadalupe?
Well, it was a beautiful moment, especially in the situation that we are at, that we live in a world that sometimes seems to be hopeless. And I think the message of the Blessed Mother that she's there for us, that's what she told Juan Diego, I'm here, that I am your mother. So I think it was a beautiful message that resonated to all of us and to me especially, because that gives hope, no? We ask the Blessed Mother for her intercession to plead for us to Lord Jesus Christ, her son. And so it was a beautiful moment of hope and a beautiful moment of gratitude for her intercession and seeing thousands, hundreds of people, and it will be thousands coming through the Basilica these days. but very diverse group of people, it was also a beautiful image, you know, like we are all united and we're all together and our faith brings us together and the Blessed Mother keep us under her mantle. So that was very moving for me and very hopeful moment, an inspiring moment to be all together with all the people that were at the Basilica that night.
Can you mentioned Juan Diego. Can you take us to 1531 and this apparition and why she is such a powerful symbol of Mexican faith?
History has it that, so that's at the moment of the conquistadors from Spain and different things going on, evangelization at the same time, the natives over there, the indigenous people. So it was a very tumultuous time for the people in general. And so the church was trying to evangelize all these new people. And it was just that there was this comfort and anguish and it seemed to be hopeless for people. And so the church tried to really protect the indigenous people and it was having a hard time. And then the Blessed Mother just appeared at the perfect moment to Juan Diego, who seemed to have lost his faith and lost his hope. And she appears to him and she brings a message to him, a message of unity, a message of love, a message of understanding. And he's challenged to go and to speak to the authorities about this apparition. And he'd rather do other things. And he feels because he's a native, he's an indigenous person, that nobody will listen to him. And the Blessed Mother tell him, no, I'm choosing you. I'm choosing you, my son, to send you on this mission. And so he goes and announces this apparition. And so it was a beautiful miracle that the Blessed Mother appeared to him and gave hope to him. And in a way, if you look at the image of the Blessed Mother, it's a mixture of the cultures that were coming together at that moment. And so it was a powerful and a hopeful message for Juan Diego, who probably at the moment felt that he was worthless. And at the moment he felt that nobody really paid attention to him or cared for him. But the Blessed Mother, the Mother of God, it came and appeared to him and encouraged him to share that good news with others. So it was a beautiful moment for him.
Father Juan, you were born in Colombia. What was your relationship to Our Lady of Guadalupe growing up?
This is an interesting thing because, of course, as a Hispanic, as a person born in Colombia, we have different devotions to the Blessed Mother. And mm-hmm. and the devotion to the Blessed Mother, as I was, especially the Blessed Mother of Our Lady of Guadalupe, as I was growing up, was something that was kind of in a smaller scale, if you will. And it was more like a specific for the Mexican people, but with the pontificate of St. John Paul II, he really made different trips to Our Lady of Guadalupe Basilica in Mexico and actually promoted the devotion to the Blessed Mother, Our Lady of Guadalupe. And he consecrated the whole world to her and also named her the patroness of all Americas. Mm-hmm. And so we started to grow the devotion. And right now, I even have a niece that her name is Guadalupe. So it's growing. It's beautiful devotion that is growing all over the Americas.
So after being in Milwaukee, the statue will travel to Fond du Lac, to Green Bay, La Crosse, Chippewa Falls, Madison, and Stevens Point, and then making its way to Europe and Africa. What is the task like to move a statue of this size?
It is a very challenging task, and it needs a lot of logistics and a lot of work to just set it up. And that's why we choose a place, and then the Blessed Mother, the statue, stays there for a few days, and then move to another place because the setting up and the taking down, it takes a while. She travels in a trailer. And she mm-hmm. goes with a group of people who come from the Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe in Mexico, accompany her, and making sure that so the statue comes with a whole like if you will spiritual experience. So there's music, there is reflections, there's the story of the apparition. There's a lot that the pilgrims who come to visit the statue, they get to experience in that moment. So it's not just like you come and see and take a picture and leave. No, but it's rather rather it becomes a spiritual moment of prayer or connecting with the Blessed Mother and a moment of growth. And then they also get to white ribbon where they can write down their prayers and the petitions. And these prayers and petitions will be taken to the Basilica of Guadalupe in Mexico by our bishop in June to have a special mass there in the Basilica offering for the intentions of the people of God here in Wisconsin.
So many people will be able to see the statue.
Yes, yes. And it has been a beautiful few days there in the Basilica and people just constantly going and visiting. Yesterday, I was at my parish doing masses. And so we were discussing with people and people were scheduled to come during the day to visit the Blessed Mother. So I think it's a beautiful boost, if you will, of hope and joy to the faithful here in the Archdiocese of Milwaukee.
Hope and joy has been hard to come by, Father Juan. I mean, in the U.S., there is such an immigration crackdown. There is a fear of deportation. How does this moment, this event, seeing the statue and its symbols resonate with what people may need or feel?
I think it's so appropriate because this has been something in the making for a long time by the people of the Basilica in Mexico, and it came to fruition this past summer that it started down in Chicago in the Plains where we have a Basilica of Our Lady Guadalupe. And so it has been just providential. And I think for us, people of faith, hope that we don't lose that. Our hope is in our Lord. And as St. Paul will tell us in his letters, hope never disappoints. And so we always keep to our faith, even in the moments of darkness, in the moments of fear, in the moments of hesitation and anguish. We always stay strong in our faith and holding to the hope of Christ that he promised us a new life in him. And the visit of the Blessed Mother of this statue just is a reaffirmation on our faith and a reaffirmation on the hope of the Lord that there's always light at the end of the day. And there's always... You know, we are preparing Lent for Holy Week, and we celebrate Good Friday that our Lord died on the cross, but then we also celebrate the Easter Sunday, the resurrection. So death is not the last thing, but the joy of the resurrection. And I think this visit of the Blessed Mother gives us that and reassures us that we are not alone, that our Lord walks with us even in the midst of these difficult and challenging times for all of us.
We are not alone. Father Juan, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you for having me, and thank you for covering this opportunity and this moment so special for so many Catholics here in Wisconsin.
That is Father Juan Camacho, the Vicar for Hispanic Ministry in the Archdiocese of Milwaukee. He is pastor to 8 parishes in Racine, and he was with us to talk about the life-sized holy statue of Our Lady of Guadalupe that is making its way across the globe to honor the 500th year apparition. It will travel to different cities across Wisconsin until April, when it will go overseas to Europe and Africa.
Wisconsin Today producers include Trevor Hook and Mackenzie Crummy.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.